Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled A Threadbare Universe, and it is about Jason Baldinger's new collection of poems called A Threadbare Universe. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about Jason Baldinger's collection of poems, A Threadbare Universe. Jason Baldinger, actually, regular. I mean, you are now definitely the most frequent guest.
Eight or nine?
Eight, something like that, yes. And this is episode eight. And ooh, that sounds really good. This is episode 89. So if you're eight or nine, you've literally been in 1/10 of the episodes.
Well, then I'm keeping with my 10%, you know, world. I'm a 10%er. I get to be 10% of your podcast.
Sounds good. Maybe we have to engineer it as the glacial pace that these podcasts go on. I think either have to be 99 or 100. Guess 99.
Shouldn't be a problem. 100. Shouldn't be a problem. I've got two more books coming out this year at least.
That's great. So we'll do at least two more in the 2021 calendar year then. This is wonderful. Because, you know, it's not like you can go reading, it's not like you can go on tour. We got Zoom and Audacity and this podcast.
Leaving me alone with my mind is always a bad idea.
Yes. You know, now that you bring it up, the thought in my mind, and we already noticed this while walking our dog around our neighborhood, like people are going to have to learn how to human again. If this ever ends, if there's ever a magic moment where we're like, you know, infection rates are so super low, or enough people have been jabbed that even if you get it, it's just a really annoying cold or something.
Yeah.
We are going to be an entire nation of super awkward teenagers all over again, and teen drivers, and just bad teen everything at once.
You know, there was a moment, I think maybe in November, where I was walking from my warehouse that I work in to the diner around the corner. And I ran into a woman who smiled at me. You know, she was wearing a mask, but she smiled at me. And I got so confused and flustered in that moment because I don't remember what it was like when strangers smiled at you. That I was just like, hi! just stumbled off in two different directions. But we made eye contact and you could tell she was excited to just be acknowledged. And I understand that. And I'm sure everybody's feeling that way at a certain point in time. You have your bubble, you have your pod that you're in, you know, and outside of that, we don't necessarily see other people. So when you do, there's this clumsy, wait, what am I supposed to be doing right now?
Yeah. You know, I've been teaching online from home since all of this started. And I keep joking with my students that, you know, next year, if there is a next year, if there's a next semester and we're back to normal or ish, that it's going to be so weird for them to see me on campus. Like they'll literally be like, oh my God, you're that dude from my laptop. You know?
I've never met you before. I'm so excited to finally meet you.
I thought you'd be taller or something. Exactly that moment. And so, and you know, it's funny, I say that and you joke about that, but I was rereading this collection again today to prep for this. Not that I'm saying that these are poems from the before time.
They are the poems from the before time.
They are the poems from the before time. And for me, you know, it was struck again about, you know, your poetics is so much about being out there in the world. You know, how many postcard poems are there?
Yeah.
Collection, work poems, night at the bar poems. I'm sure, you know, and I know I'm on some Facebook groups with you, so I know you are still composing and still working. And so I would just, maybe you want to start with, can we start with asking about like how has the pandemic affected your poetics? How PhD in literature is that question? I clean up very well.
It's been fucking rough. I mean, I finished this, I think, in February. So, like, this book, I don't think ends even before there's a mention of pandemic. Which is weird because I also just blurbed a book for John Grahalski, whose book ends with the last day out. So, like, I also, like you, just read a book where you see that moment, you know, again. And we didn't recognize it as that moment. We didn't realize, even though with the abundance of caution that we probably should have had and some foresight, understood that this was going to go on for longer than a year. And so here we are now, you know, a year plus in with 3 to 5 months minimum, and still no guarantee even at that point in time we're going to be out of mask world. You know, we might be open, but we might not be out of mask world. We might never be out of mask world again now. So it's been hell. There's been an adjustment to try and figure out how you write about a world that has become so insular all of a sudden. It's been difficult. I think I probably produced the least amount of poems over the course of that February through through the beginning of this year. But I went and did my yearly pilgrimage to Delaware, which I always do between Christmas and New Year's, which I was somewhat dreading and somewhat anticipating at the same time. It's very weird to travel now. You've done day trips, but actually doing like night out in motel and trying to work the logistics of that world is wholly different. And it sort of sparked a whole series of poems. So the last month or so has been incredibly busy writing poems about places that I miss, people that I miss, stories that I haven't necessarily been able to put out there, just didn't have it hadn't come up as pressing or this or that. We also are moving into a decade since I did a cross country. So my cross country drives, you know, in 2011 and 2012 are sitting in my brain heavily at this point. So I'm now maybe fetishizing a world that I can't have, or just writing about something that I miss. And that's been incredibly fruitful. Also, the weariness that 2020, I think, put into all of us, even if you understood this system didn't work rolling into 2020, even if you were well aware of how piss poor this system is for 90%, I think we all got a bucket of ice water on us, even at that point. I don't want to necessarily say my faith in institutions is at its lowest, but yeah, it might be.
It's what it means to not feel the floor.
Yes. Yeah.
You always think at least there was a cellar.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you slip through the cracks, there's a cellar.
You understand there's no such thing as rock bottom because you can just keep going.
Yeah. I have a neighbor across the street who spent some time in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just post-apartheid South Africa, but still. And her thing she said to me, and she said this to me in 2017,
mm-hmm.
mid-2017, she goes, I go to these meetings of, people, Pittsburgh liberals or whatever, and these women, she's like, I always laugh, these women say, well, it can't get any worse. And she would laugh, and she's like, you have no idea how much worse it can get. You don't know what is possible for humans to do.
Mm-hmm.
That stuck with me, and it's like we got really, really close. That psychic damage, that lack of a present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're all dealing with trauma now.
Yeah,
we're dealing with multiple national traumas, multiple pandemics in a way. And that in its own right, for anyone, let alone an artist, I mean, you're unburying yourself and trying to like just see over the head, you know, over the hedge just a little bit at this point. Yeah.
And to get past that sense of unreality.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's like there is that little cop in all of our heads. Like, no, you can't say that. That's just, no one's gonna believe that.
No, and that's the important part too. Keep talking about it so it doesn't become too wibbly wobbly,
yeah,
for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, which I thought about this a lot too as I was reading The Threadbare Universe, because I remember a time at the record store, a mutual friend and I came in and we were talking, and that mutual friend was like, oh, wow, well, I want to have a creative writing night at my house and we'll have prompts and we'll do things. And it was so informative to me because you were like, oh, well, I don't do prompts. I don't believe in prompts. For me, if it is something that happens to me that I could talk to somebody about over dinner, it could be a poem.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And thinking about that advice and then thinking about the other thing that's just so great about your poetry, especially as of late, is your ability to infuse historical, I won't say metaphysical, but philosophical meaning into the everyday.
Oh, thank you.
And to do it in this way that seems totally not labored, that comes off as totally effortless, that the lines just breathe. I think you're the one that convinced me to give up on punctuation.
Yeah. Yeah. And thanks, Chris Collins, for making me give up on punctuation too.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's a thing that's passed down. Anybody out there that's an aspiring writer, especially a poet, give up on your punctuation. Your poems will do all sorts of new things now without them. They don't need them.
Yeah, that's what line breaks for.
Yep, exactly. Make it work.
I still hold on to the period at the end.
That's fair. I mean,
I like a period at the end.
Signature thing for you, and you know, that becomes your own little thing. That,
well, that's, you know, identify. To borrow the Paulo Freire phrase, all of us have a cop in our head.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one place where that's jaywalking or something. But no, I was thinking about that in the before time and why I went to ask this question about poetics, because yeah, that's the thing, you know, so much of your poetics is about travel, is about encounters, is about just coming to understand the weight and meaning of a place.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so easy, I think, in whether it's, you know, modernity or is it just this culture where you can come to a place and not have any sense of how that place got to where it was when you met it.
Yeah.
And
you can take it as completely blind as you want, but my brain is history wired, and
yeah,
I need context. There's poets who come to the city to do shows, and when I take them around, I have to tell them a story about every block.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
They've said, it seems as though I tell you some story about every block, and it's important to me. Every step carries weight. You know, everywhere you've been, there's a story, whether it's attached to you or whether it's attached to somebody else, and it becomes part of you. You know, I guess it's the ultimate virus, isn't it? Storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it mutates and it things. But so, yeah. So, I'm glad to hear you're still producing, even if not as much, but yeah, this is a hard time to be creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. But speaking of that poetics of place, that's a bad, rough transition, but what the hell? Actually, could you hit us with a poem? Is there a poem you'd like to read, or a few poems or whatever?
I'm sorry, what was the second part?
Poems you'd like to read, or whatever?
I'll read you the last poem in A Threadbare Universe, Cape Henelope and Blues, and then maybe I'll read you a new one after that. The Cape Henelope and Blues. Among the coastal pine, the heron, the fescue, I look up on a sky that hangs heavy with words unsaid. Horizon catches fire, standing on a sandbar washed in red and lighthouse. Tide roars the other side of the cape, I have prayers to throw into the ocean. North Star above thumbnail moon. Miles Davis's peaceful those of the car. My niece asked my resolution. I told her I didn't believe that time. I didn't believe that time is not linear. Narratives and timelines don't kowtow to calendars. It's something understood better as you get older. No fireworks tonight. Warm December. Escape light pollution. To hail Orion's stars. Joint on my lips. Gull fights the noise of an approximately infinite ocean. Alone on the dunes. Time has passed. And how about this? May have a title change happening here. Hang on, computer's being slow getting me to it.
That's quite all right. That is a lovely poem. And
oh, thank you. Apropos to our discussion, as time gets weird.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This is currently called Larry Levis and Phil Levine, but maybe changed to the Deep Ellum Blues. It's for a Dallas poet, Paul Konecki. I've never seen Dallas from a DC 10 at night, but the saw that floats through that song is every phantom embodied across the miles, Lubbock to Wichita Falls. I've never taken the ramp, followed 287 into the Zapruder film. The spool ran out. Now history is a Butthole Surfers video. Alan Dulles was wholly responsible for Kennedy's assassination. For America's second bloody coup, the powers that be learned about martyrs and then went bloodless. He was killed because the Cuban Missile Crisis had turned him from hawk to chicken hawk. It had torn out his spine and left him with a world longing for peace. Revenge and capitalism can survive peace. Hence Lee Harvey Oswald, hence Jack Ruby. Hence, what really happened on the grassy knoll will carry its weight in mystery. Paul, I headed for Texarkana because sometimes the road offers no salvation. Sometimes the wheels are another form of madness. We should be smoking joints in the backyard of Oswald's rooming house. And you'd look at me as Larry Levis and say, so death blows its little fucking trumpet. Big deal. And I'd answer as Phil Levine, I can hear the even breathing of all that is wordless and final. The Butthole Surfers play the Shah sleeps in Lee Harvey's grave. And maybe our preaching days are through, because when the night rolls out, dusts off all its Tejas stars, fuck if I don't fall hard into the Deep Ellum Blues. All right, back-to-back poems. There you go.
All right. Wow. Speechless. It's a podcast. Must say words.
No, that's fair.
That's fair. No, I love how also it seems like your poetics has evolved, because you've been on every 10th. We've talked about your poetics now, you know, 8 or 9 times. How much more stark, how much more concise your lines are.
I spent most of last year working on a selected poems, which is one of the books that will be coming out later this year, currently titled The History of Backroads Misplaced. Mm-hmm. And it made me, well, I shouldn't say it made me, I didn't have copies of some of the earlier stuff other than in book format anymore. It's on old computers, old hard drives that I could not access.
Oh, wow.
So I had to retype by hand, or retype everything up until the book that didn't come out in 2016. So it made me look at my writing and re-edit things and rethink about things that I had already written a decade ago. And it that way of rethinking about my work has just made me cut even more fat out and has, I think, honed the lines even more. So it was a fantastic exercise and highly recommend doing it when you get there. You know, take that, you know, 10 books or 10 years or whatever and make a big fucking book out of it. It sharpened a lot of things for me.
Wow. This sounds like a totally useful, but wow, what a pain in the ass.
Well, it did take me most of last year. I think the book is 135 poems or something like that. It's close to 200 pages. I mean, there's 14 books in that time. And certainly one of those books, Fragments of the Rainy Season, which was never released. I just took like 25 poems that I really liked out of that book, basically a full third of it, and just rewrote them and put them back out there. So it'll be the first time they're available.
Wow.
In any other format that isn't Bandcamp, you can hear me read that book in its original form that way, but it has now been cannibalized into that and another project, the upcoming Baldinger Benger 3 book, which he and I are just getting our legs on. So,
and I had James on not too long ago, 2 episodes ago.
Yeah, I listened. I was quite happy to hear you both.
Yeah, it was nice. It was a good comeback episode.
Yeah. it's really nice. You know, I don't get a chance to talk to James all that often. We pass messages back and forth, but I hadn't talked to him in a while, and just to get to hear both of your voices and you talking about things, really, yeah, it made me feel good. So thank you, and thank you for having him on again.
Yeah, no, I definitely, and definitely he'll be back, because that dude also writes every day.
He does.
He
does.
Still manages to do that.
I don't write every day, but
yeah.
You know, I'm thinking every day at least.
Yeah. Which is a form of writing, which also I think, you know, this idea of something ever being done or something ever being so set, you know, and I think once you get past that, it's, and that's just so liberating that you can have to retype. So, man, maybe that's my obstacle. Maybe that's a thing I should have my students try.
I recommend it because you have to part with the old draft in some way, shape, or form. And I mean, I work very quickly, I've never done a lot of drafts. If something didn't work, you know, you save it, you come back to it, you hammer at it, you add, you subtract, whatever. You know, but you're constantly refining until you get to book form, and hopefully it's in its final form at that point. And for the most part, everything after 2017 wasn't much, you know, a little tweak here or there, a little change of phrase, but anything before 2017 really, you know, there was, it was like, oh no, I see me and it's there, but that isn't quite me anymore. I didn't want, you know, obviously when the book comes out, that statement will exist better, but I didn't want there to be this thing where it was like, oh, that's JB 10 years ago and that's JB now. It was like, no, I want one book that reads like it was done now. You know?
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That's interesting. And it makes me think, because, you know, one of the things I remember in my days as a Writing Center tutor, trying to explain to students that Microsoft Word as a tool, which is a very nice tool. I mean, it's backlit kind of like the menu at Sheets, you know. You know, it's like it's glowing and stuff. And so it looks really good. You know, this idea of articulating a thought, articulating into words and polishing it, which are really 3 separate steps.
Yeah.
How much Word, because you can just move those things around so easy, tries to collapse those 3 distinct steps into one.
And you so, can... Yeah. Do that, but it has to then be ingrained into how you write, you know.
Yeah,
that's advanced, you know, that's not start.
Yeah, which, so, you know, was when for me, it's like when students collapse and, well, not collapse, but when they stumble is when they are trying to write, trying to do all three of those steps in one big grandiose move, and they get sort of muscle bound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about how much now my own process is trying to do, yeah, and trying to build into it this whole sense of what would it happen? What would happen if I, and I mean, I guess I have done it. I mean, I had some things I published or not published, but I composed on a Brother word processor that had a two color monitor that was, those things were saved on floppy disk. I at least printed those things out and I saved them. And then I did have to recompose them because I had to retype them. But I didn't think of that as any conscious decision or conscious idea. But what a revision step that you have to literally go back and justify any just, any that, any punctuation.
Yeah, exactly. Take it out, you know, cut the line in a different way. Let me see if I can find, looking for one of the poems that, oh, this is a poem from the book that didn't come out, which is Fragments of a Rainy Season. This has been rewritten and retooled for the upcoming Baldinger Banger book. So you probably haven't heard this in a long time, if at all. I'm sorry, I'm also just going to step on you while you're in mid-thought and read you a poem.
No, go for it. Right. Do it. No, this is it. Do it. You're doing the
thing. We're doing this shit live, yo.
We're doing it live.
You got me thinking, that's all.
That's all right, and that's good, and I want to hear more poems anyway.
Cool.
And I have my next question, which may be supplanted by what happens, poem. What's about to happen, yes.
There's multiple realities happening after every word that we say, so what the hell, right?
Yeah.
The hymn to Groundhog Day. This cafe is contrary, a strange anomaly in a land of diners. Walls, paper, brick, with watercolor Mustangs, one calendar, two posters of the Hulk, one Hulk decal on the cooler, and I wonder about the calendar to quality ratio, an equation mastered in blue highways, then wonder how many Hulk posters equal a calendar. The waitress says her son raises groundhogs. And I don't know what to say. Maybe she's fucking with me. I look deep in the Hulk's eyes. This year, he has 42 groundhogs. I say that sure is a lot of groundhogs. Bessemer tunnels and carbon snow. A few towns away, my mother's family settled in the 1850s, dropping the A and the E, dropping the family crest and marrying into a family with a township named after them. A yellow sign juts up from snow in surrender. I miss the America I grew up in. I want to believe this is a statement on a widening gap in equality, on the erosion of class, on the working person giving it away, giving everything away, on the ways we allow government to fail in not mandating social responsibility. Instead, it's another conservative screed about the good old days that never were, times when people went to church, family values happened, and abortions didn't. The stop signs have addendums. One says, stop touching me. One says, stop, hump me. The last says, stop and dance. These winter messages are so conflicted. I hunt frozen snakes along the Kiskaminakis. Here in the bleak of February, I fill myself with enough gray to crush the restlessness that grows with each snow. Punxsutawney, 10 hours after the groundhog, he saw a shadow. So did this town. There is no evidence this civilization still tries to understand weather through the eyes of animals. Baldinger Banger 3 coming later this year.
Yes. And there'll be a podcast, of course.
I'm sure there will be.
Yes. So the question I have.
Yeah.
It's still the same question, actually, since, you know, you talked about there is this version of this book that exists on Bandcamp.
Mm-hmm.
That people can hear. People can hear, you know, the unreleased deep cut. archival material. And that is part of your I don't say poetic franchise, but your life as a poet or whatever, that you have the books, that you have the band camp. And so
your oeuvre.
And you read
pretentious word.
It's all right. It's a good word. And you read so well. So the question is for me is, as part of your writing process, what role, if any, does reading aloud have as part of your poetic process?
Well, as you're writing and editing, or at least as I am, I'm constantly trying to keep it out loud in my head so rhythm, you know, tempo and everything stays in there. And obviously those things are going to change as you go, but you should be able, whenever you think a poem is done, to be able to read it through without stumbling over it. There shouldn't be a word punching you back. You need to be able to flow with it and not be fighting your own language. And that's the best answer I can really give you at that point in time. There's something that's tripping you up. If your brain is not catching the rhythm, if you know the sound of the words doesn't work for rhythm, change it, cut it, fix it, do something else with it. It's not ready yet.
Burn it, send it to hell where it belongs.
Yes. Burn it in a campfire. So yeah, I think it's really important that you read through and know where you're going with it, and your brain wraps around it at the same point in time. You're not asking yourself questions as you're going. You know, luxury of having been in front of an audience enough, you take some of the workshopping you get back from an audience, you know, and you tuck it into your little your bag of tools. Same with your editing, you know, as you edit, as you talk to other people about editing, you see what they do, or you have people give you suggestions, then that becomes a thing that you immediately put into your tool bag. So they're not things you think about anymore. They're immediately done. Or hopefully immediately done if it becomes, you know, if it becomes part of your process. These days, that's how it works for me.
Yeah, I know that makes a lot of sense. And that makes, you know, makes me think about what I say to a lot of students. You know, I throw a lot of process and a lot of possibilities at them. Mm-hmm. And there's that encouragement, like, you know, what works for you, how to fold it into process, and how to become, I hate to use the word when in thinking about poetics, I hate to use the word efficiency. But
I think there's a good place to have, you know, for efficiency, especially if it's a poem. You don't need a lot of dressing in the window. You need the substance and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, anything, you know, you can add something superfluous. You can have a funny line or a funny aside, you know, that can tie in, but, you know, have the story going in some trajectory. You don't need to throw a whole bunch of extra shit in there. Also, if I did that, the poems would get really fucking complicated with how, you know, the narrative structure at a certain point.
Yeah. Which, again, I think to go back to that is that, you know, your poems are, they do have complicated narrative structures. As stark as the language is, as clear as the language is, again, there's this way that these worlds collide.
I've learned how to map my brain pretty well. So it's kind of a straight line. To me, that's how I think. You know, like I oftentimes, you know, big conversations can be hard because I always want to go back and go forward at the same time. Like, I have an answer for something you said an hour ago that my brain just got, and I need to get that to you. But we're talking about this, and it oftentimes all gets jumbled in there and then comes out in this sort of double helix wraparound structure. And, you know, so that's the map of my brain. That's how things go. I'm going backwards and forwards in time while I'm writing, trying to understand what I'm doing.
No, but again, I think it's really important for us to have that sense of place. Now, of course, it's also a thing, like that's a Neil Cassidy thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was something Allen Ginsberg said about Neil Cassidy, is that he could, as part of a conversation, trace all the way back to the genesis of the spontaneous thought that he had.
I wish I could do that. Do you know how many more poems I'd write?
But how Protestant work ethic is that, right?
Yeah.
You can always make, you have how many books coming out in 2021?
Probably three.
But you could always have more. There could be a...
Well, yeah, I mean, as I work on this new series of poems, which is seemingly obviously a chapbook at this moment, it's like, okay, I know the few more things that I want to write about that definitely fit this series. Will there be more? Do I call this a chapbook, or am I holding out for another book? I'm trying to figure that part out right now. It definitely feels like a chapbook. I feel like it's the sequel to Blind Into Leaving, but not sure. You know, I'm still, you know, flittering through all the thought processes and answering the four or five poems as they continue to congeal around in my head. You know, figure out what they are and where they're going and whatnot. So,
and so for you, what is the chapbook to collect, the proper book or whatever, proper book or whatever, how you say that, chapbook versus book distinction?
That's a hard distinction. I mean, you know, so, you know, working with James, essentially, you're turning James over a chapbook, or James is turning you over a chapbook, and you're you know, building a book out of that. So you're already starting at a chapbook and then building a real book, or a full book. Sorry, real book. Yeah, wrong choice of words in every way.
Yeah,
because they're all real books.
They're all real books.
There is nothing less to making a chapbook or to making a book. You know.
How about this? Books with staples.
Yes, as opposed to books with glue. There you go. That's the delineation that needs to be there. They're all the same amount of work.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if the book is 20 pages or 50 pages. It is honestly the same amount of work. You know. So, yeah, I mean, if over the last few years, I've been able to do that chapbook with James, you know, and then build that into a book with Wine Drunk and with The State of the Country, there was always this other series of poems that you could write that could be a direct response to what was going on now. So that got to create its own book. You can sort of, through most of the books that I think I've written, there's at least a theme that coalesces around, whether it just be this is 1 year, or whether it's, you know, I put this together with intent to give to somebody else, and then we built more of a book out of it, or flesh it out to a glue book instead of a staple book. I think you notice, though, when you're writing about a theme and what it, that theme feels like, and whether that is, you know, is going to come to an end or not, which I guess is weird because I do write about the same thing, road stories, travels, but there's a certain, what's being espoused, I think, all tied together in a certain way. Jason Reberg, who does Kung Fu Treachery Press and Spartan Press, asked me to do a split book with him and Sean Pavey that may come out this year, next year, sometime. Don't know when.
Yeah.
And so I basically sat down with every poem that I had written last year and read through everything and made two piles. And it was like, this definitely works as a chapbook together. That I can send to James. This is a whole weird dystopian thing that might make its own book too. Together, they might make a really interesting book, but separate, I think they'll stand on their own better and serve the work better. And maybe that's the question that you just have to ask yourself. How are you serving your work? What is the best avenue to serve that work? I don't know. That's a long, probably total nonsense explanation.
No, that makes sense. And I think it's illuminating for me and part of why I enjoy having you on so much. And actually, I think part of now, I think the new we're all going to die. No, the new, but like where I want to go with this podcast and why after taking almost a full year off, but you know, also just figuring out technology and re-envisioning it is that, you know, what can I do to help demystify craft for people or demystify art for people?
Yeah, I think that's a really good mission. Yeah. I think all of us have spent this last year sort of hunkered down a little bit and refining, you know, some of the things that we're thinking or doing. It's a confusing time, so refinement seems difficult in that. But
well, I think is it also that we have perspective, or at least I think the pandemic has at least given me some perspective. Especially when I think about like, are we ever actually going to go back?
Right.
To the world as it was,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think we are. I mean, there's institutions that aren't going to make it, you know, even if it's just a nice restaurant that I like or something is just not going to be there anymore. Or maybe certain social rituals aren't going to be there anymore. Yeah. It has me thinking about, I think we've all had to kind of think about, well, how does the world actually work? And how does everything that we do actually come together now that we've had to figure out a new way to live and have to rethink everything?
For as large as the world seems, it has become infinitely smaller.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to then see all the ties in between everything for the first time. And I think a lot of people are seeing that more clearly, you know, perhaps than ever before. Yeah. There's also the fact that as a student of history, you know, most governments don't last through pandemics. Governments can't match the needs of the people. So things change inevitably, whether it happens during or after. Something seismic has to happen. And of course, we've seen what happened at the Capitol. That is not the appropriate version of that.
Yeah.
You know, so there will be a leap of some sort as we move ahead, as we try and gain traction to normalcy. But whatever that normalcy is, I don't think we know. And for a country that is always vilified, you know, failure, UBI and other things are going to become very essential as we look at a larger disabled class.
Yeah.
You know, because this pandemic is going to create so many people that aren't going to be able to work for any number of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have differently abled class from 15 to 85, you know, and it's going to cut the workforce like crazy. And we may actually have to adjust to a post-industrial revolution, you know, model, which should have been adopted already. But what do I know?
Yeah, it is weird not being a member of the ruling class, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How much lovely that must be to be a member of the, because I mean, whatever the world's going to be, it is not going to be March 14th, 2020.
Never
there
again.
There will never be a March 14th, 2020. The March 14th, 2020 that we were supposed to have, which actually I think I did go somewhere. I did go to a place. Self-consciously, I went to two places.
That was the night that I went to Trader Joe's as they were closing at 7 o'clock, and there was literally nothing in the store but the shit people won't eat.
Wow.
The shelves were literally bare, except for 25 items that people don't eat. That apocalypse moment, that you know, George Romero world that we've existed within in some capacity. Yeah. Now, that for me, I mean, I already, you know, lost both of my jobs that day. So it was already a weird day, but then it got weirder.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. What a thought. Actually, I was wondering if I could make a request. Can I make a reading request?
Yes, you may. What would you
Speaking
like?
of where we are, where we've been. And I guess maybe the one thing that's been good about the pandemic is that it has kind of stopped the school shooting. That's kind of nice. So a lot of people like, right? Or at least the mass shooting has been kind of like, you know, curtailed somewhat.
Yeah. We can't shoot each other because we're not publicly available to each other anymore.
Yes. And so
that's positive.
Yeah, so I was wondering if I could hear, and this is one that really stuck with me, Saturday is My City Bleeds.
Oh, sure.
Which is on page 40.
Thank you.
No problem.
I was about to go, where is that? Okay.
Yes.
Saturday as My City Bleeds. Morning news sits like a rock. I thought lunch was a good idea. A siren comes audible. Restaurant stops. Air goes out of the room. And everybody holds on. The rest of the country sends thoughts and prayers. For 24 hours, we'll mourn 11 dead. And there'll be a 30-second debate about our love affair with guns. Robert Bauer's name will be committed to a database with the other mass shooters. And no one will remember the victim's name, except here in Pittsburgh, except their families. Screw your optics, I'm going in. Another white man disaffected. The media loathe to call it a terrorist. It doesn't fit the assumed profile the one 9/11 made popular. But when you commit murder, when you take lives, when you shout, all Jews must die, as you finger the trigger, let there be no mistake that that is what you are. The problem is it's just another statistic. Even in Pittsburgh, where Richard Poplawski, an ex-Marine, boarded himself into his apartment and took the lives of three police officers after anti-Obama, anti-Jewish rape. Where George Sondini walked into an LA Fitness and killed three women and then himself, all because he blamed women for his inability to find a mate. Where John Schick killed one, shot seven before the police gunned him down. He had been plagued by harassing complaints from women. It said the neighbors avoided him. I typed this poem. Computer notifications ring. People mark themselves safe. How fucked up is it to wake up to an active shooter drill in your own neighborhood? How fucked up is it that you can't feel safe in a place of worship, in a movie theater, while you exercise, in a hospital, in a school, in a bar, in your workplace, on the street, as a woman, as a person of color, as a transgendered person, as a Jew, ultimately and simply as a human. And I wonder, how much blood do you need, America?
Yeah. Thank you for reading that.
No problem. Oh. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. That was a rough day for all of us.
Yeah.
At least we don't have to have the debate currently, I guess. Wonder. Boy, that's a grim joke. I'm sorry. I was gonna say,
no.
I wonder what the first mass shooting, when this all comes normal, will whether there will actually be a conversation, or whether we'll just immediately go back into that same algorithm of, oh, thoughts and prayers.
The BoJack Horseman too episode. Soon. It's, we can't change things.
Yeah. The BoJack Horseman episode. That's really good for that. You know, where they're filming a movie where a woman's shooting an entire mall full of people, and they keep getting mass shooter notifications on their phones. So they ultimately have to cut it down into like a small commercial.
Yeah,
but every time there's a shooting, somebody just says thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me is that the most distressing thing about this period, time period. And I felt it before the pandemic, and certainly feel it now. Just the complete incapacity to solve the most basic problems.
Yeah.
And What do we do with that? What do any of us do with that?
Well, conversations are a good place to start, you know. Yep. But getting everybody involved in the conversation becomes difficult, and
I think for me, it's like, who still believes in American exceptionalism? It was weird the day of the Capitol day.
Mm-hmm.
Every person I know who has a green card on their social media at one place or another said, American exceptionalism is bullshit. Mm-hmm. I hope you all realize right now, this means that American exceptionalism is bullshit.
Yep. Yep.
And those people all come from places that have history,
mm-hmm.
that have a strong sense of history and a very bad history. Whereas I think how many people, part of the failure of our having a conversation is just the utter failure to be willing to admit that we need to have a conversation, or we are not the shining city on the hill.
No, if any year could prove to you that the ideology of America and the actual America are not in two completely different places, I think 2020 just sort of did that very well. And that's terribly unfortunate. And the Capitol riot only proved that system further. That was one of the things that drove me nuts throughout impeachment, is nobody necessarily said, we wouldn't be having this conversation or this trial if it had gone the other way, if they had been successful. There would not have been even a remote attempt at accountability. There would be no room for the conversation at all. And that is terrifying. And the institutional hubris is amazing.
I want to hear one more poem before we skip to the bottom five. And I want it to be the Stanton Avenue Blues. You can actually, if you want to read more than that, but I want to read the Stanton, I want you to, if you could, the Stanton on page 113, Avenue Blues. And as you look forward, if you think about also something else, that reminds me of something from the Ai Weiwei documentary, Never Sorry, where he was talking about how being in the U.S. during Iran-Contra and how amazing it was for him, the thought that a government could put itself on trial.
Yeah,
as a signpost of freedom,
mm-hmm.
and a
requirement. And it's disappointing that there weren't consequences. Not that I don't believe there still could be consequences, but that there wasn't at least the first flag of consequence to go up to tell us that maybe this whole bullshit neoliberal boys club agenda that has been happening for the last 50 years. Obviously going back further, but this particular cancer of America is about 50 years old. Stanton Avenue Blues. Taking turns on Pittsburgh goat paths 20 miles too fast. Each stop sign, push the volume a couple more notches, bass notes steady, seconds vibrate, my head with enough buzz vibrates lightning. Every street of memory goes in a rearview mirror. Rilke said, you are the future. I don't know how to see the future now anymore. I'll read you one more, man. Let me just find it. Oh, wait, I might actually have that on paper. I do have it on paper.
Look at that.
Holy shit, I don't have to go digging for things.
Hey.
This is going to be published soon in As It Ought to Be online magazine. It's called Let Go of Atlantis. Jerry believes in ivory soap. He believes in starch collars. His spine is straight. He says all the flying plagues of Florida are nearsighted. Don't give them room to smell. I miss the manatees out in some cove near a launch pad. That's etched in our consciousness. I see it in the rear view and I want to write about shoveling snow as a boy, about dreams exploding, about hot cocoa and Krista McAuliffe. Jerry says for 15 bones, they'll give me a sea kayak, and I can paddle over the surf to a barrier island all my own. Out there, cooking hamburger helper over a pocket rocket, I'll turn back ahead time. I'll forget my coop and go native. Going native is a racist term meant to minimize the people who were killed so this land could be our land, a universe of violence. It seems to me that every inch of this land is steeped in blood, and I wonder if a barrier island off the coast of the Atlantic may be one of the few places I can step where that blood doesn't well up a hot spring of unacknowledged history. I'm going to stay out. An island a mile away from civilization, the sun paints the sky every 12 hours. Every day the ocean steps a little higher. When it reaches my neck, I'll know it's time to let go of Atlantis.
Fantastic.
Thank you, sir.
And best way for people to get a Threadbare Universe or anything Jason Baldinger related?
Send me a message on Facebook.
All right, there you go. Send me a message on Facebook.
Threadbare is also available at Caliban Books if you're out and about. But yeah, I mean, I can send you one for $15 and I'll even sign it. If you're in America, of course.
There you go. All right. And now it's time for the bottom five.
Okay, what do we got?
All right, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And I believe, I don't think you've had these questions before.
You have to write new questions for me at this point.
I keep writing new questions. And so there's a supplemental sheet. This is the Jason Baldinger sheet. But actually, I think I wrote this sheet before your last podcast. So let's see here. Question one. If you were our new dictator, what would your first edict be?
Oh, shit. There's so many things that need done.
There's so many things. What would be the first thing?
Redistribution of wealth from the billionaires down.
Okay. Good one. Solid.
It's the way to fix everything, but you start there, at least it works.
Yes.
Jeff Bezos has $1 billion now. The rest of it is ours.
Yes, that works. Question two. Even if I asked this question before, circumstances change, so we don't know. Mm-hmm. Question two. Are you prepared at this time to aid an escaped prisoner?
Yes. I've been preparing. You know, things were getting very ugly at the end, and I had some difficult conversations with some of my my Jewish friends in particular. So I was trying to make sure that if we needed to hide in floorboards, it could be taken care of.
Question three. What is a question you wish you could ask a person who is no longer with us?
Wow. Okay. Ask me question four. Let me think about that a minute.
Okay. Which, you know what? Oh, crap. I hope I didn't ask you question four already, which is tell me about the worst car you've ever driven.
That was my 85 Dodge Omni. I bought my first car, cash on the barrel head. It was a Duquesne Light Company car with no tape deck, no radio, or no power steering. And about a month after I got that car, a week after I got my license, drunk driver rear-ended me and totaled that car. So the guy that I had worked in an auto garage with set me up with a beater car that he got at an auto auction for like $900. And for the 11 months that car lasted, it did nothing but take money out of my wallet. So that was definitely the worst car.
Do you want to hear question five?
Yeah, let's go with question five. I'm still working on question three back there. I mean,
yeah. All right, question five. What professional athlete is your personal embodiment of evil?
Oh, God.
If sports is our mythology.
We'll make it easy. I know he's probably got one more year left here, but it's Pittsburgh, so we can just make it Ben Roethlisberger, right?
Yes.
I think that probably kind of sums up all the privilege and all the bullshit that comes with professional sports. So, Ben Roethlisberger.
Great choice. I thought you might have went with Sid Bream, but...
I could make a case for Sid Bream, but you know, Sid Bream was such an everyman.
Yeah.
You know, I can't hate him for being an everyman. You know, he broke my heart.
Yes.
But
he's so slow, such a slow runner too.
Exactly. You know, I turned 45 years old in July. I can't tell you how many things have broken my heart at this point in time. You get over that part. That's not the hard part anymore. So, you know.
Yeah. And the thing about it, too, the worst thing about Sid Bream is if he ran a little faster, then he wouldn't have even. Oh, he scored. He just caught the ball. But yeah, Ben Roethlisberger is a great choice. I think about, for me, I have two former students from another university where I taught who were waitresses in a now defunct Northside sports bar.
Okay.
And he gave them some real problems and did some really terrible things.
Yeah, I've heard some aside stories along the way, too. They've never been good.
Yeah.
So
supposedly, one of the line chefs chased him out with a meat cleaver, and he never came back. Which would have been the hell of a story.
Mm.
But
I like that as a you know. Chasing football players with meat cleavers out of restaurants is a great idea.
Yeah, especially that football player.
I'm really stumped on the third question. I'm trying to think of a question to ask the history. I'm trying to think of something that needs to be demystified. There are so many things and so few things. Like, we could demystify the Kennedy assassination and you know, get that. Let's go with Charlie Manson. I read a lot about Charlie Manson this summer. So,
okay.
What really happened? And I don't want to go too far down a crazy rabbit hole here.
Yeah.
But if you read Ed Sanders' book, The Family, and then you read, there's a Tom O'Neill book that came out that isn't great, but it's decent. He talks about the possibility of the CIA having put Charles Manson where he was. Mm. And if you read through those last few years, he is constantly on a get out of jail free card. So even as the murders were happening on the front page, the Spahn Ranch was raided the same day. Nobody put two and two together. And Charlie was arrested four times in that month thereafter before he was actually picked up for the murders.
Wow.
So, there's some very weird peculiarities to that story that I would love to have cleared up. That's the best I can do on short notice. I mean, there's so many other things we could attempt to demystify, I suppose.
Or remystify, who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. So I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Actually, it'll be probably in about a week. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes is gunnadiepodcast.com. We're on, I believe, we're still on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and we're on Mixcloud. Oh, those are the classic episodes, we're on Mixcloud, because you got to upload those yourself. by hand. It's hard, annoying. So, but I'll do that eventually. And eventually, I will be putting some of these episodes on YouTube so that folks who might be somewhat hearing impaired can enjoy them, at least with YouTube's auto-generated captions, which I know aren't perfect. But this will be eventually available, just the audio on YouTube as a thing. And again, follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you to our guest, Jason Baldinger. Again, the best way to get the Threadbare Universe, I almost read the sign on the cover of the book, a Threadbare Universe. Message Jason on Facebook. It's not hard. Anywhere in the world, you can get it signed, $15. You should do it. It's a really good book.
Anywhere in the U.S., not in the world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, anywhere in the U.S. Sorry, international shipping is a pain and hard. Anywhere in the U.S., $15. Sorry, those 10 of you who listen in New Zealand. Something Spotify taught me. Apparently, we have some small... Hi. You know, Mr. Regular calls New Zealand the planet's bonus track, which...
Hi, Bill Doreen.
Hi. But yeah, reach out to Jason on Facebook, get it, and I'll have links to the Bandcamp page and all that fun stuff. Later, meets. 2, 3, 4...